MechCast, Friday, November 13th, 2015. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, I am not going to do a whole lot of intro today because we have another Amigos episode for you. So I invited over my friends Victor Cajiao and Ken Ray to come chat about the latest happenings and going-ons in the world of Apple. So we sat down and talked to those guys. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. It's always fun when we can all get together and sort of have a little back and forth. Of course, iPad Pro is going to be one of the things that we discuss a little bit. Didn't get into a lot of deep detail. Look forward to me talking about that on the next episode of the MacCast. I've had my Mac or my iPad Pro. Did I say Mac Pro? I might have said Mac Pro. I've had my iPad Pro now for about 48 hours. I like it so far, and I've shared my initial thoughts on a couple other podcasts if you want to check those out. The Mac Show over at the British Tech Network. I also talked a little bit with Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer on the Daily Observations podcast. So you can check out my initial reactions there. Also on Twitter, I've been commenting a little bit. But I really want to take a little more time to form some more solid opinions before we really sit down and discuss it here on the MacCast. So I'm going to be spending the weekend with it. Look forward to my thoughts and opinions next week. If you have questions, you're also always welcome to email me or send in an audio comment or something like that, or if you have your own first impressions of an iPad Pro, if you've picked one up. But we're going to get into that and some other things in this episode, and it should be a lot of fun. But before I get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Drobo. I let you know last time that Drobo was back as a sponsor of the MacCast, and I'm very excited to have them back with us. They've been big supporters of podcasts since the very beginning, and we really appreciate that. In case you don't know what a Drobo is, it is a family of safe, expandable, yet simple to use storage devices. And they offer a whole range of products for just about everyone from IT folks to professionals to home users like us. And the basic principles behind the Drobo products are kind of three tiers that they look at. One, they understand that our data is essential. Two, they understand that we need to keep it safe. And I think third and most importantly, they understand that we always need more, right? Isn't that the case? No matter how much storage we have, you always need more. And you know, for me, archiving and doing backups and keeping your data safe is really important. And that's why I like having Drobo as a sponsor, because their devices solve these issues. They're designed and built to kind of fulfill these three principles. And the other thing I really like about the Drobo is it's simple to use. So it is a RAID-like storage device. They call it actually Beyond RAID. And it's there to protect your data and keep it safe. It allows you to very easily mix and match hard drives. So you buy a Drobo, and then you can either get it with drives or you can bring your own drives. You put those in there, and it doesn't matter what you have. So if you have a 1 gig or a 1 terabyte and a 2 terabyte and a 500 megabyte, you can pop all those into your Drobo, and it will magically RAID it together, figure it out, put it all together, and give you data storage plus redundancy. And there's a bunch of ways you can configure and set it up with the Drobo dashboard software. And in case you're wondering, you know, how much storage am I going to get with my drives? They have a great calculator on their website. You can go check that out. And they've really handled all of the hard stuff that you would normally have to do in setting up a RAID. So you can figure this stuff out on your own, but you don't have to with a Drobo. And then on the front of it, they monitor your storage. So you get lights to let you know how much storage you're using, when a drive is getting full. And if there is a problem, I mean, hard drives fail. It's just a natural thing. Over time, they eventually fail, and it will notify you of that. And then you can simply go out, get a new drive. You pop the old one out, pop the new one in, and it will take care of repairing everything, putting it all back together, and putting your RAID back together again. It really is that simple. I've had Drobos for a while, had drives fail, and I didn't have to panic. I saw the light on the thing. I looked at the dashboard. It said, hey, this drive has failed. went out and bought a new one, just swapped it in. Some other important features in the Drobos, some models offer SSD accelerated performance. So they're all fast, but if you want to get more performance, you can put in an mSATA SSD card and get more caching, a little more performance out of that. Many of them are also optimized for Time Machine, so you absolutely can use them for your Time Machine backups. And I have both the Drobo Gen 3, the 4-bay, as well as a Drobo 5D, and I use them mainly for archiving and backup. You can also use them for your movie storage and iTunes and things like that. And if you go with a network device like the Drobo 5N, which is a networked version of the Drobo, it even has apps and apps like Plex. So you could set up your entire Plex server on your Drobo with all your movies and content. And now that the new Apple TV has the Plex application, yeah, you can serve up all your Plex media right to your Apple TV from, say, a Drobo 5N. They have really great solutions, including mobile solutions like the Drobo Mini. And here is the best part. Right now, MacCast listeners can get $100 off either a Drobo Mini, a Drobo Gen 3, or a Drobo 5N by going to drobo.com/MacCast and then using the discount code CAST100. That's CAST100 at the Drobo store. Just go to drobo.com/MacCast for all of the details. And that means you can get a Drobo for as little as $199 right now. That is a screaming deal. So a big thank you to Drobo for their continued support of podcasts and shows like the MacCast. All right, let's just get right into my conversation with Victor Cahiao and Ken Ray, the Amigos. Well, hey, Ken and Victor, thanks for coming back on for another Amigos show. How are you guys doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. And Victor, sorry, I should have taken you one at a time. That was very unprofessional of me.
No, it's okay. I'm wonderful. Good to be here.
I never sometimes quite know how to start these things. So this is it. This is what you get when Adam doesn't know what to say when he started off this thing. But it's just been a while, and I figured it was time for us to get back together. Unfortunately, Dave Sparks, who's also usually on these things with us, was unavailable. But hopefully we'll be able to get him in next time. But a lot of stuff has been going on, and I just wanted to get you guys together to talk about a few things. And I wasn't really planning on this first topic per se. I mean, we were going to think about talking about iPad Pro in the sense of, are we going to be getting them? Figuring that we're recording this on Thursday, and they probably weren't going to be out and available. But Apple, in their infinite wisdom, even though they told us differently in their press release, they had them in retail stores. And I know that I picked one up and Victor did, but I think you did not, Ken, right?
Right.
Yeah. But really what I wanted to talk about now that this has happened is more something that we also, I think, experienced with the Apple TV. And that is, what is going on with Apple and their seeming inability to know when they're actually going to release a product and where it's going to be sold and all of these other things. I was extremely frustrated with both launches, and I don't know about you guys. So, I mean, maybe I'll start with you, Ken. I mean, does this bother you as much as it bothers me, or is this just a thing that, you know, I'm being stupid about?
No, it kind of bothers me. It bothers me less about the iPad Pro, and I'll be curious to find out why it bothers you about the iPad Pro, because at least going into that machine, you knew, right? When you ordered on Wednesday, and you didn't know what time you're going to be able to order on Wednesday.
Right.
But when you ordered on Wednesday, right there on the screen, there was the option for in-store pickup. Now, what's funny about that is I got three emails from this one guy that day, I think because of the way the Apple TV launch had gone, saying, so it looks like Apple made a mistake. It says that it's available for in-store pickup. I went ahead and signed up for that, but I doubt that that's actually true. I'll email you later.
That's how I felt.
Yeah, and then he got a confirmation email saying, okay, come on into the store and pick it up. And he's like, yeah, I'm still going to call before I go in because this can't be real. But, I mean, at least you did know, like, you know, right at the start. The Apple TV one was very frustrating. Probably more so for you and me because we were wanting to talk about them for other people. You know, like I wanted to talk about it on iChart Radio and Mac OS Ken. I hear you have a show that you might have wanted to talk about it on as well.
Yeah.
And so to find out, so you can order it and then great, and then pay extra and you might get it sooner, but you might not get it sooner. And then after you've already ordered and, you know, committed to spending the money, because I think it was by the time we knew that they were available in the store on Friday, it was already to a point in the ordering process where you couldn't cancel the order.
Yeah. Yeah. Apple got an extra $20 from me. That I'm not getting back.
They did not get that money from me because I didn't see that was the other thing. It was, I think if you paid the $17, you were guaranteed to get it between October 30th and November 3rd.
Something like it, yeah.
But if you didn't pay the extra $20 or the $17, then you were guaranteed to get it between the 2nd and the 4th of November. So you might pay the $20 and not even get it early. Plus then you could have just gone into the store and get it. So that one was a bit more frustrating to me because, oh man, I paid this money and now people who didn't, I get to go into the store and pick one up today. It really is strange though, these things used to be like clockwork. Like every year you stay up until 3 a.m. on the East Coast, midnight on the West Coast to order your iPhone. But right. Then Apple TV or iPad, yeah, you know, whatever. Well, stop by.
Yeah, and I want to get your take on this too, Victor, because again, like even before that, you know, sort of the situation was you had to go to the Apple retail store if you wanted it day one, right? Way, way back when. That's when we used to wait in the long lines and all that stuff. And then Apple changed that and sort of preconditioned us. Hey, if you pre-order it, you're going to get it day one, you know, via FedEx or UPS or however we ship them to you. But I guess, Victor, you know, what's your sense of why they suddenly can't seem to manage this stuff anymore?
You know, I don't know, but it is definitely frustrating. I was really frustrated about just the lack of information regarding iPad Pro launch. I mean, there was just nothing, crickets, you know, nobody was saying anything. So that was, you know, item one. And then for myself, I think it was on the 11th or the 6th, anyways, last Friday, Mac Mall all of a sudden, you know, had them for pre-order. So I ordered one from there, you know, and I thought, okay, I'm good to go, you know. But then, you know, on Wednesday, we finally hear about it. You know, no reviews have been done yet. Nothing has happened. All of a sudden, they don't even tell us it's going to be Wednesday at midnight. And all of a sudden it is. And then we get, you know, kind of like the double whammy. A, sure, you can order them. B, you can go and pick them up the next day. And then C, oh, but if you want a keyboard or a pencil, good luck. Those aren't coming. So, yeah, a lot of lack of information and just kind of, you know, one more time, this sort of you get what you get. Now, the only thing that I can think of that kind of even makes this make a little bit of sense is something that I read earlier in the week where the person who's in charge of the stores now, the retail experience, I can't
Angela
remember.
Angela Ahrens.
Angela was talking about her desire to finally bring together the online buying experience with the in-store buying experience because they have always been two separate animals and they just don't talk to each other. So the only thing I can think of is that they're in the process of that transition right now and some of the widgets are in place to make some of that happen, but not all of them are. And therefore, there's a little bit of chaos going on. And maybe it's because they're getting ready for the Christmas season and they want to have some of that in place for the Christmas orders. That's the only reason I can think of.
It's interesting you bring up that word chaos. Mm-hmm. And this idea that they're trying to redefine an experience and that experience isn't quite finished or together. And this may be the sort of result of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that because now I'm going to transition. So, you know, I think everybody gets like this has been a mess with this whole pre-order thing. And I'm hoping it's something that they sort out, and who knows whether they will, or if this is the new norm. I'm hoping it's not the new norm, but that idea of an experience that somehow is half baked is probably too extreme for this, but just not polished. Like, we're used to having experiences from Apple. I'm feeling like this is spilling over across the entire sort of company. And I'm somewhat baffled by that. And I'd like to get your guys' take on this too, because you know, you can talk about whichever products you have, because I know we all don't have iPad Pros and we all don't have Apple TVs. But in both cases, since I do have both and I've gone through the experience of both, both these product launches, and even to some degree, OS X El Capitan and iOS 9 and the latest iPhone launch, all of these things, I love the products. I still think they're great. I think there's a lot of great things in all of them. But particularly with the Apple TV and the iPad Pro, you know, Victor, you mentioned the accessories not being available. I think this is a good example of it. Or on the Apple TV, the fact that Siri doesn't work with Apple Music. There's like this unpolishedness to a lot of the things that Apple's been doing lately, where it seems like, wow, why didn't you guys just wait 2 weeks to release the iPad Pro so that the accessories were available? Or why didn't you wait a week? Because it's sounding like, you know, in the next iOS update, the Apple Music stuff is going to be there in Siri. Why didn't you just wait a little bit longer and polish these things up and make it that, you know, great user experience, instead of, it feels like, pushing things out the door and then like being more the Google thing. Oh, we'll fix that later. You know, it's okay. And, you know, maybe that, maybe I just answered my whole own question. Maybe it's because that's how most people do things now. It's just not what we've typically expected from Apple.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ken.
Well, before we get too much into things like, you know, the operating system on Apple TV and things like that, I want to sort of back up to some of what you're talking about with Angela Arendt, with the head of Apple Retail. She comes from fashion. She doesn't come from, you know, we stood in line for a day or 2 days or 3 days to get an iPhone. I didn't, by the way. But I mean, she doesn't come from that crowd, right? She doesn't come from that group of people. I wonder if Apple is trying to move more towards just a more fashionable, more casual, more ubiquitous sort of launch. Like, yeah, stuff's just going to be there. Do you know what I mean? If they're trying to pull away from the sheeple image that's presented, like in the Samsung ads and things like that, I wonder if they're trying to make it less of an event and more of a just, you know, it is thing. Because I mean, there's I mean, we consider it geek cred to stand in line for a new Apple device. Yeah. Other people just concentrate on the geek part. Do you know what I mean? I mean, is she trying to go for a more general consumer vibe rather than catering to the nerds? Which I mean, as cool as an Apple Watch is, and as cool as the first iPhone was, and the second iPhone, and all the iPhones, as cool as all of those things were and are, a certain level of geek is cool, a certain level of geek is not. And I wonder if she's trying to take it more towards a more fashionable thing rather than a, I haven't showered in 4 days, but I was the first one with an iPhone.
Yeah. And, you know, Ken, I would tend to agree with you, but let me throw in a couple of things specifically to this iPad Pro launch that kind of counter go against that. And the first one is that, well, first of all, if she comes from the fashion industry, I mean, the standard in the fashion industry is that you're showing off your fall line months in advance. So it's definitely not a catch-as-catch-can, you know, here's our latest product thing. Everybody knows what's going to be launched in the next cycle. And then secondly, and this one really took me by surprise, was the lack of consistency even at the store level. I compared notes with Adam yesterday. He lives 60 miles away from me. His Apple store apparently had at least a keyboard that they could show you and a pencil that they could show you.
Two keyboards and three pencils.
There you go.
Was the pencil just laying out where you were, by the way? Because I talked to Barry Folk. That was amazing to me. And I understand it because you want it to like feel the way it's going to feel, right? And I don't think if you had it tethered, you could do that. But he sent me a picture and I was like, seriously, that's just laying there.
And it was very close in my retail store. The iPad Pros were just to the left of the door inside.
But Adam, you had iPad Pros that were being displayed. Is that true?
That is true. They were all there. So just to comment on Ken's thing, I honestly, because Sebastian Page from iDownload blog is good. We go to the same Apple retail store and he was there. And I was testing out and I just looked at him and I'm like, okay, I am so tempted to just like grab this and run. Like, I don't think they could catch me. course, I'm not going to do that. But the thought did go through your mind. You're like, oh, I could have this.
But so. And my point was that the store where I was, they didn't even have them out. There was not a single iPad Pro to be found when that store opened. That was weird to me. There was clearly a table that was empty that had pads where they were going to be, but there was not one to be found. I asked about it, and she was like, you might want to come back tomorrow and be able to pick some of that stuff up. I was like, really? And so to me, that just, it was a surprise because that's not what I'm used to as far as, you know, the way that they do business on these launches. It's usually a very unified front. You're going to get the same thing in Chicago as you're going to get in Anaheim. And that's kind of what took me by surprise as like the last whammy on this one, that this one seemed kind of off the cuff and it's like, let's just do it. Instead of, like you said, Adam, I think they just should have waited the 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe it's because they feel they're not going to have enough inventory. Cause I just looked today and I mean, the pencil and the keyboard are now back ordered 4 to 5 weeks. So it started out at 1 to 2 by the end of the day yesterday. I think it was at 3 to 4 weeks and now it's at 4 to 5 weeks. So not really sure what's happening there. And maybe just demand is extremely outstripping what they thought it was going to be.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though. 2 weeks from today is Thanksgiving, right?
Mm-hmm.
As we record this? Yeah. I mean, so there's not much weight left.
Right. I mean, my delivery dates were 19th to the 27th, and I got in there pretty early. So that was a little shocking. And now hearing that, Adam, that means that if people are ordering pencils and the keyboards, they must be ordering the iPads. Now, I think we heard of numbers, or I read of numbers of 2.5 million potentially as a first run. So it'll be interesting to see if what you're saying ends up to be true, because I can't imagine if they anticipated that much, 2.5 million units, let's just say that as a number for discussion, that they wouldn't have then, you know, made a proportionally equal number of pens and keyboards, you know, a fraction thereof, if you will.
A fraction. The thing is, you have to remember 2.5. I mean, that was the number that was being thrown out by supply chain. You know, who knows if that's accurate or not in terms of the number of units that they planned to produce between launch and the end of the year. But the other thing is that they did launch simultaneously in 40 countries. So that's not a lot of units to go around if you compare that to other things that Apple sells. But again, you compare it to the iPad and you kind of go, oh, that probably makes sense because this is, you know, nobody is quite figured out who this product is necessarily for. And by the way, I think that's just sort of a wrong approach that everybody's taking anyway. But it's, you know, there's a lot of questions surrounding like, you know, where is this going to sell? Is it this? Is it that or the other? And so Apple may have hedged the bets a little bit and said, you know, it's probably better we don't overproduce these things.
Yeah. I'm sorry. When you say you think that's a wrong approach that everybody's taking, what do you mean?
I think what I'm finding now that I have one, because I sort of had those questions as well. I guess it's the right question to ask, but now that it's out in here, I'm starting to read some things about it and those sorts of things. I think the fallout of you're seeing is now that the product exists, and this happened with the iPad and this happened with, you know, different size screens of iPhones and things like that. It's the same approach to technology that I think you almost always want to take, which is what is the way that I want to work in the way that I do things and what is the right device that sort of answers those workflow questions. A lot of people approach it from, you know, how can this technology allow me to do certain things? I guess I'm not probably explaining this right. But, you know, it's like, I want this technology, and then they want to dismiss it because it doesn't sort of fit the workflow that they have. So they buy the technology first and then go, oh, it sucks because it doesn't fit my workflow. As opposed to saying, here's how I want to work. Here is the operating system experience I like and I want to have. What device does Apple sell that is going to work best for that, the way I want to work, as opposed to just rushing out and going, I don't get it. You know, this is a MacBook or a MacBook Air. Why wouldn't I just get that? You know, so I don't know if that makes sense, if I'm making any sense there, but that's sort of how I'm feeling about it. So like the approach that I've taken is the reason I wanted to get the iPad Pro, and I've talked about this on my show, is when I'm mobile, I've found over the last couple of years that I really prefer the iOS experience and using individualized apps and being very focused on certain tasks and not having a lot of windows open and not having a lot of things. I like for certain things being able to have the iPad in my hand. The shortcomings that I've experienced are with that, and the reason why I take my notebook with me along with my iPad very often when I'm traveling is where I have to do more typing, where I have to take notes, where I have to maybe write some code, do those sorts of things. That doesn't work very well with the on-screen keyboard on an iPad. So the fact that I know that I really desire and want an iOS experience in my mobile platform, but where I've reached some limitations with that, I think that the iPad Pro solves. That's why I'm very excited about the iPad Pro. But I know other people that that'll never work for them, that they really need multiple windows and they want a desktop and they need, you know, more storage and all of these local storage and all these other sorts of things. And in those cases, you know, those people are probably the ones that, hey, you probably should have a maybe an iMac at home and your mobile platform is a MacBook or, a 11-inch MacBook Air, something that's light and portable. But still has the desktop experience with the desktop OS and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's actually where I am on the iPad Pro. I mean, my MacBook Pro is about 4 years old now, and I will be looking to replace it at some point relatively soon. And I can't see dropping, you know, between $800 and $1,000, maybe more, because I know what I'm going to want to do is get the Pencil, because I'm going to want the Pencil just because I'm going to want the Pencil, even if I have no real use for it on a daily basis. Because
it's cool.
But that's what I hear. I mean, Barry went nuts about the whole thing when he got to play with it. And of course, I'm going to want a keyboard for it, whether that's the Logitech for $150 or the, you know, Apple's smart cover or smart keyboard, excuse me. It's not a smart cover. Smart keyboard for $170. I mean, I'm looking at approaching $1,000, even if I go for the least expensive of the iPad Pros. And then I would be doing exactly what you're talking about. Okay, so can I now make this do everything that I do on my desktop? Well, I mean, not a desktop, a laptop, I mean. But then just get a laptop.
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing that Apple has done, you know, unlike sort of what Microsoft is doing, where it's like, we want to give you the desktop experience everywhere, you know, on mobile and on desktop. Apple has taken this opposite approach where I really think going forward, they're dividing their user base to a certain degree. And there's going to be a few people that are in the middle that are crossover. Mm-hmm. But I think for a large part, what they're saying is we have iOS solutions that go all the way from, you know, being ultra mobile with like an iPhone all the way up through an iPad Pro that's going to give you what more traditionally, you know, people would think of as a notebook experience, but within the iOS ecosystem. And then on the Mac side, we have everything from, you know, a 27-inch iMac desktop thing all the way down to this little tiny, super portable Mac Pro. And pricing wise, everything's kind of the same. Performance wise, everything's coming out the same, because we're hearing a lot about the iPad Pro, you know, being in a performance range of a lot of, you know, very mobile notebooks, including Apple's own line of notebooks. The benchmarking is working out where the performance is there. So now it's not about price. It's not about, you know, performance. It's, you know, the question becomes, what experience do you want to have? What kind of apps do you want to run? And here's, you know, then you choose your device. And it's an interesting thing to me that's sort of happening. But I think there's going to be, you know, people where it's, you know, Mac and OS X all the way across the board. I think there's going to be people where it's, I'm just going to do iOS all the way across the board. And then there's going to be a few people in between, but I think it's going to get less and less where they sort of bounce between the two. I don't know. Is that too heady?
No. I think honestly, what I thought about, Tim Cook has said a few times on his recent international journey, that he's only carrying the iPad Pro and the iPhone now. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing to hear. I mean, he is the CEO of the company, so you're not, I mean, it's not really an overly surprising thing for him to say right this minute. Whether that's true in a year will be interesting, but I don't think he'll keep saying it over and over again unless he says it on the earnings call every 3 months. My mom has only used an iPad for about the past year and a half to 2 years now. I mean, she has an iPhone. She's like Tim Cook. She has an iPhone and she has an iPad, and she hasn't used a computer. Yep. She had like a cruddy netbook, but she hasn't used a computer for the past couple of years. And it was me basically like talking to her about what she did on her computer and then giving her my iPad to play with and saying, do everything that you do on your computer. Try to do everything that you do on your computer. And it did not take her any time to realize she didn't need to, you know, sink the money on a computer. Now, Tim Cook is not editing audio on a daily basis. Tim Cook is not, I don't even know about the rest of the stuff. I mean, I don't know. Tim Cook, I feel certain, doesn't work in CAD. I don't know if you could do CAD on an iPad at this point, because I haven't looked at every single app that's available, because there are like a million. I know you can do audio editing on the iPad, but it just doesn't fit, you know, my personal, it doesn't fit my personal workflow, how I want to work. But I mean, most people are checking email. Most people are surfing the web. Most people are watching video. Most people are not doing something that requires actually a full on computer.
Yeah. Here,
go ahead.
Real quick on the audio editing thing. So you can do the audio editing on an iPad. And I guess what I'm getting at is what you have to really decide is, do you care or want to? And what's great is you don't have to. Like, right. You can stick with the Mac desktop. But if you really wanted to change your workflow and figure it out, you could make it work with just an iPad. But what you have to first decide is the iPad experience the experience that I want as my computing experience going forward? And if that is, then you can make it work. And I think, you know, if you read anything from Federico Vici, you can understand that. And yes, there's going to be challenges and you're going to have to work out workflows. But I also realized that, you know, I've spent 10, 15, 20 years figuring out desktop workflows. We haven't even had iPads for that that long. I know if I spent the same amount of time figuring out an iPad workflow, I'm going to be amazing and be able to do a bazillion things on the iPad, right?
Yeah. And don't misunderstand, I wasn't saying you couldn't do that on an iPad. Right. I mean, it's very much about, I mean, yes, I've spent, people who've heard this before must be bored hearing me say it. I'm coming up close on 20 years of the audio editing tools that I use, because I started using Cool Edit in 1998. Cool Edit was bought by Adobe. It was turned into Adobe Audition. And I, you know, I've gone a couple of different ways a couple of times. I used whatever the audio thing was that was tied to Final Cut. I can't remember what that was called anymore. I've used GarageBand. I've used Audacity. I mean, I've used a bunch of different ones, but what I always want to come back to is Cool Edit, which is now Adobe Audition.
Right.
And so, you know, 17 years later, I'm not overly interested in working my workflow.
That's what I'm saying. We're kind of at a great time because you don't have to, and you obviously very well know what kind of workflow you like and what kind of experience you like, and you know what platform that is on, and you can stick with that platform. And that is great. Just like I've realized for my mobile experience, I really like the iOS thing. So I'm going to go down that path. And I'm going to be one of those weird people that's sort of in the middle, because there's certain tasks that I also like a desktop for. But those are generally desk-bound tasks for me, which works out great for the sort of workflow that I want to set up for myself. You know, I'm probably not going to edit the show on an iPad. There are occasions when I have to do some mobile stuff, and I don't know what my solution is going to be there, but less and less, I'm traveling less and less, I'm going to less and less conferences, and that was typically when I would have to do audio on the road. 90% of the time when I'm doing audio, I'm going to be at my desk with my studio mic and my whole setup anyway. And none of this gear is portable. I would never take it with me. So that works out fine.
So what I see happening that is, I think, the trigger point for what's going on now with iPad Air 2, certainly iPad Pro, is that finally I am seeing the other side of this equation, the developers starting to write specifically for these devices as enhancement devices to what's on the desktop. Let me give you the examples. Adobe is the perfect example for this right now. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Photoshop Fix, Photoshop Mix, Lightroom, Adobe Sketch and Draw, they're sweet right now. They're doing something very smart. They're writing applications for the iPad specifically that are incredibly robust but simple to use in the iPad UI. So for a guy like me who is editing pictures and doing all the things I want to do, I'm able to do those in this device, and the device now becomes an extension of my desktop away from my desktop. Because unlike before, where you were kind of stuck within that ecosystem, what Adobe is doing now is they're taking the complexity of the application and they're saying, okay, when I'm done working on my portable device, I simply can export that back to my desktop applications, the big boys.
Right.
And all of the complexity now is there. The layers that I could not see when I was working on the iPads all appear before me. So all of these complex things that would have taken me an incredibly complex UI to work on if I was doing it on the iPad, they've overcome that by making the UI on the iPad very specific to your task. But then when you go back to your desktop, it looks like the traditional thing. That is the way to do it. That is what's compelled me to move towards the space. They haven't done it with Audition yet, Ken. I think they will. I think they will. Because, again, the key is this ability to take the UI very specific to what you're using in the iPad Pro, and then now extending it to my desktop. When I come back home, I have as much complexity as I want. That to me is the key. And then of course the big screen, being able to use this as a Cintiq, for example, using an application, what is the application that I'm going to be using for that? AstroPad. You know, that's why I'm looking forward to Pencil, because AstroPad will let me use this as the input tool to do the brushing on Photoshop on my desktop. So it becomes this incredibly great extension that is portable and I can take with me. And that is very compelling to me. When it comes to my music side, there's a whole other set of arguments, you know, that I can do with my, for example, the USB extension key. I can plug my MIDI keyboards and play the iPad right in GarageBand and then export those files back into Logic when I get back to my desktop. You know, I can take a simple audio interface, again with a USB, go out and do a field recording of a guitar player in GarageBand using a click track, and then bring it back into the Beat Boy when I get home. To me, that's why this device, and I'm trying to replace a MacBook Air, seems to be finally the right size, and the developers are getting to the point where they can fulfill that mission without it being a full OS.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially the approach that the Adobe apps are taking. What was interesting about that to me too, again, and this goes back sort of to the mental rethinking that I think some people need to do about their workflows on a desktop, is, you know, Adobe is breaking up those little tasks, like you were saying, Victor, into, okay, I have a photo, I need to do some, you know, healing brush and some retouching, and that's sort of the fix sort of thing, or I need to do some compositing, and I think that's the mix, right?
That's the mix, yeah.
So they've broken those tasks into these little individualized apps, right? And you just take the file from one to the other on the iPad so that, you know, you're only sort of working on that one experience at a time. But under the hood, it's building up this layered Photoshop file just like you would in Photoshop. So it's essentially the same workflow. It's just you're not seeing everything at once. And even on the desktop, if you really think about how you work, you're generally only doing one of those tasks at a time anyway. Even though all of the capability is sitting there in front of you in the UI in Photoshop, if I'm doing retouching, I'm really only, you know, spending 20, 30 minutes, an hour on my retouching tasks. And then I'm going over and I'm doing my adjustment tasks. And then I'm going over and doing my compositing. You know, you're not kind of, maybe some people bounce back and forth between those, you know, frequently. But my experience has always been I'm kind of doing one and then the other. And maybe you are bouncing back and forth. And on the iPad, I guess you'd have to be jumping between apps. But it's essentially the same workflow, just how you're interacting with that workflow is a little bit different.
That's right. And for me, I'm finding that it keeps me actually more focused on those specific tasks when I'm working with them within the UI of Fix or just the UI of, you know, Adobe Comp. The other thing that it does, of course, for them, it plays right into their hand of saying, you know, you have our subscription model.
Right.
Now the dependency is, okay, I have dependency on all of these applications that talk back to all of these wonderful desktop applications. Guess what? I'm probably going to continue to pay you that $40 a month or whatever it is.
Well, yeah. And then they throw on top of that with Adobe, right? You get the cloud storage. So that solves some of the storage limitations that you're going to wind up with creative professionals on a device like the iPad. I mean, if you have a 32 gig iPad Pro, you know, the cloud is going to be the only way you're going to be able to have that kind of workflow.
Yeah, and I'm not, you know, as I'm sure you know, we're not talking about working with small JPEG files. We're talking about 30, 40 meg raw files that are being, you know, worked on the iPad Pro itself.
Yeah.
Or the Air 2.
Yeah.
32 gigabytes actually surprised me. Are the two choices 32 or 128?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, that's not the same thing as the 16 gigabyte iPhone getting people to buy the 164. To get the 64, I don't think. Because it's a bigger jump. And the 32 gigabytes is not... That's not nearly enough for the kinds of things that you're wanting to do with that machine, it doesn't seem to me.
So the answer that I've been told from a lot of people, and this makes sense both for the iPhone and now for the iPad Pro, is volume purchases in enterprise. Mm-hmm. So enterprise likes to go with the less storage model because in a lot of cases, these things are things that are doled out to people at the office. They're being used at the office where there's network attached storage and stuff that's available there. You're pulling files off of file servers and things like that. They don't generally need. They're also very controlled in terms of the number of applications that you can throw on there. So, you know, employees are not, they're locked down. They're not allowed to, you know, install giant games or put their personal files on there generally. So they like the lower price point and lower cost of, you know, something like a 16 gig iPhone, because they know, you know, we're just going to install these four apps and your email and that sort of thing. And again, I think a lot of executives and people in business are going to be doled out things like an iPad Pro for a lot of the same reasons. And so that was the answer that I was told. And it kind of makes sense to me when I think about that. So I think Apple's thinking most consumers are going to be getting the larger size devices, but this is more about they need to have something in the lineup that when IBM comes and says, we need 5,000 of these things, you know, that's the one that they're going to be bulk buying and then deploying out within their enterprise. And for iPad Pro, I would imagine education is the same sort of thing, right? You're going to have a cart of these things that are going around from classroom to classroom, and you're going to have image files where for any given task, you know, like a science day with iPads or something like that, you're going to install that image that has just the applications the kids are going to be using that day, and you're not going to need a lot of extra storage. It's a much more controlled environment.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So, and it keeps the pricing low. Somebody also told me there's some weird thing about 8 gigabyte flash modules versus 16 gigabyte modules right now in terms of the pricing, and I haven't looked into this in the supply chain, but like, it's not just like double the price for the 16s. Like manufacturing those is somehow more tricky or difficult. And it's like 3 or 4 times the price versus, you know, just doubling up like 8s or something like that. So then it becomes a space issue. You know, when you only have so much space and you're trying to cram in more storage, you need bigger chips. Or, I mean, the chips are all essentially the same size, right? Under the hood, they just have packed in more stuff.
Right.
So, you know, if you're going to put in, you know, what is that, 4 8s versus 4 16s, the price differential, I guess, is huge. Whether or not that's true or not, I don't know. Somebody just told me that. So, real quickly, I want to get to, we kind of veered away from this little idea that I threw out there that, you know, a lot of the things that Apple's doing seem like they're, things are like unfinished, and we were going to talk a little bit about El Capitan. And I know, Ken, I don't think you've upgraded, but again, this goes to other things like little, you know, edge experiences on the Apple TV or even the iPad Pro. Like for me, El Capitan has been running fine. The upgrade sort of went fine, but I keep running into little rough edges and things that I don't understand why certain things aren't working or done. I'll give you one specific example. Like for some reason, it seems like when my machine goes to sleep right now, and I did some searching, it looks like some other people are having these problems. It will, I don't know if the drives actually unmount. My external drives will think they're unmounted or are unmounted, but every time I wake it up, they're all sitting there. And that's causing problems with some of my backup schemes, which is making me a little stressed. You know, on the Apple TV, the fact that, you know, Siri wasn't there for music, or there's no keyboard support, and these things seem like they're really odd. I'm trying to think on the iPad Pro. I don't know for you, Victor, if you've experienced this, but I seem to be getting a lot of springboard crashes. And then there's weird UI things. Like I've had a couple instances where when the on-screen keyboard comes up, instead of the shift key being saying shift on the label, it shows the special symbols. It still functions as a shift key, but it's got a visual bug to it.
You know, I haven't had that, Adam. I saw you tweeting about that, but I have not had those specific issues myself.
Yeah, and it comes and goes. It comes and goes. Or even like on iOS 9 on the iPhone, you know, weird rotational issues where, you know, especially up at the top bar, I've had instances where it's like the cropping is off and the title bar of the application slides up under the, you know, the Wi-Fi signal battery indicators and things like that, where it's just like cut off weird. And again, all these things are little fiddly nitpicky things, but they're also things that just, it feels like things are being rushed out sort of unfinished, sort of polished.
I've been trying to figure that out with Apple TV. And I think part of the problem might be apps, might be developers. I'm not saying that the problem is developers,
right.
But
no,
okay, so they did their, you know, sign up for this, and maybe you'll get an Apple TV so you can test your apps before you actually send them out. Most developers obviously didn't get that. So, I mean, it's possible that developers did not get their apps in as early as they might have because they didn't actually have the thing to test and play with. I don't understand why Apple wasn't ready for it, though.
Yeah.
Like, why is there no podcast support? Are we done?
Exactly.
My sense is that on all of these things is like Apple internally has a deadline, and I'm hoping one contributing factor, because something that happened this week that is a rumor being thrown out, is that, you know, Apple may move the next iPhone launch up a bit so that it's not in the fall, like September, October. And I have to wonder if, you know, this idea where they started sort of releasing everything all at once, all in the fall, where we get this giant product deluge, I have to wonder if maybe that isn't part of this problem, because it used to be in the past, and for good or bad, a lot of people thought this was bad, but in the past we would hear, the iPhone launch, the next version of iOS is running behind. Apple has pulled some people off of the OS X team because OS X is not coming out until the fall. To kind of help pick up the slack and
right.
Sort of get this thing finished up. Some people would argue that that was a bad thing, you know, but I think I have to wonder if now that everything's coming out all at once, they don't have that sort of luxury when, hey, I know the podcast app for the Apple TV isn't quite finished. Well, grab some people from, you know, team B and let's get it finished up so that we make the launch. Those people maybe just aren't available because they're working on their own project that's launching at the same time. So they now literally can't be pulled from another team. And so then what I end up with is it feels like, well, we set a hard deadline for the Apple TV, and they go to the engineers at one point and they say, okay, what's not ready? And they just start slashing.
Maybe.
And they're like, we'll roll it out in the next update or the update after that.
How was there also not an Apple Store app, though? I mean, that's the thing. I can understand Activision wasn't ready with Guitar Hero Live. I can understand Disney wasn't ready with Infinity 3.0. Neither of those are Apple. How Apple wasn't ready with Apple's own stuff is kind of weird to me. Now, of course, they had the big things. I mean, they had, right. You know, they had the movies that you could get. They had the trailers app. But I mean, it was just odd to me the things that weren't there.
You prioritize, being a developer, I can just say, I mean, you end up prioritizing, right? And you have to kind of decide what has to be there day one. And if something isn't quite ready, rather than sort of rushing it out the door, you know, does podcasts need to be there day one? You know, I as a podcaster would argue yes, but you know, for the wider world,
right?
Probably more people listen to podcasts on their iOS device or their iPod or, you know, than their Apple TV. I guess the exception being video podcasts. So that was weird from the video podcast perspective, because I would think a lot of people probably consume video podcasts on their Apple TV.
Yeah, yep. I would think so. Yep. There was now. Where are you hearing that the iPhone might shift to earlier? Because that's actually playing with my head on such a different level now. It's crazy.
I'd have to go back and find the source, but a couple analysts, it might have been, was it Ming-Chi Kuo? That they might push it up. And the rationale there was to get ahead of the natural lull that happens in sales towards the end of the product cycle.
Right.
So
that's so awesome. I'm sorry. I love that idea. One of the things that I've been talking about a lot on iChart Radio lately with Mike LaPlante is what an incredible moving target iPhone numbers are now. The fact that the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus launched, you know, between the fourth quarter of fiscal year 2015 and the first quarter of fiscal year 2016. And the thing that Tony Sakanagi brought up on the last earnings call, that we can't really tell what we should be thinking about iPhone past December at this point, because it's going to be a rough compare. If you tell me now that they are going to move that time again, that's like a year and a half of Tim Cook going, well, don't forget, you know, this launched on that date and then we moved this thing, and you're never going to figure out how iPhone sales are going. Got like another year and a half before you have to worry about that. I hate that idea, because I'm like a dog. I don't really like change a whole lot.
Yeah.
But I love that idea, because that's just thumbing your nose at Wall Street on so many different levels.
That I don't know about, because I don't follow that sort of thing. I would be happy to not have to constantly, you know, drop major portions of cash right before the holidays, because Apple, you know, releases everything all at. I've never been a fan of them releasing everything all at once. It's just become a nightmare. And I think it's becoming a nightmare internally too, is my sense. And I'm totally speculating. I have no evidence on any of this stuff, but I think that is what's causing some of this lack of, you know, complete seamlessness on product launches.
Yeah. Consistency. Yep.
I think it's just too much for the engineering. I can't even imagine what the summer feels like at Apple. It's got to be the worst time to be working ever. I mean, the crunch time has just got to be unbelievable. I mean, I'm sure it's that way almost all the time, but it's got to be even worse now that everything is sort of, you know, and it has to be integrated and it has to, I don't even know. I should talk to some people at Apple and see what it's like. But
I suspect that they're running into some personnel, just saturation, just not enough people. They have to just hire more people, buy more real estate, put some butts in seats in order to keep up with this kind of launch cycles on both the software and hardware side.
That's all of Silicon Valley. I mean, that's a general problem in the Valley, and has been for years and years and years now. I mean, you hear about that quite a bit. I'm trying to think of how to transition. I mean, you know, regardless, we're still getting a lot of great, great products, and you still have all the typical stuff of people, you know, saying Apple is doomed for this, that, or the other. But I don't want to sound like I'm being negative about these products, because I'm definitely not. I think they're still great products. It's just there's these little niggly rough edges that, you know, sort of any one of them by themselves is really minor, but they start happening more and more frequently, and you get a lot of them, and it's, you know, I always say it's like death by a thousand cuts sort of thing, right?
The one thing, honestly, that I would remove from all of that is Apple TV. And don't misunderstand, I was very frustrated by the experience of Apple TV in that first week in particular. Right. It's such a new thing. It's such a different thing. Probably the truest thing I've heard, I can't remember if it was Eddie Q or Tim Cook, but I think it was Eddie Q, talking about the fact that we don't actually know what this is going to look like when we're done. I mean, it really is now in the hands of developers. There are different there are experiences that we haven't even thought of yet for that. And they say the same thing about Apple Watch, and it's kind of true for Apple Watch, but it strikes me as very true for Apple TV, because you now have computing power and this big screen, and we don't know what people are going to want to do with it yet, and we don't know what the most innovative thing that a developer is going to come up with for it yet either.
I think you're totally right.
It's very much an evolving thing, and I read some article, said it in an angry way, but you've said it before in a positive way. We're Apple's developer lab. We're paying to be part of Apple's test kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's okay. I'm actually kind of interested in that, because they're changing television. Mm-hmm. and you can always say that Steve Jobs said they were changing music when they introduced the iPod. And they were certainly changing the way music was consumed. I don't know that it's actually true to say that they were changing music. They're changing television. I mean, but they're changing what we are going to expect our televisions to do, what we're going to expect them to be, how we're going to expect to interact with them.
Yep.
A single is still a single. I mean, from A Hard Day's Night and before to singles that come out today, they're still singles. How we consume them is different, but we don't interact with music in a different way. And unless you're talking about like Guitar Hero or unless you're talking about, the whole LP experience as opposed to the single experience as opposed to the streaming experience.
It's funny you mentioned the LP experience and you're talking about Apple TV, because just as you were saying that, and I hadn't thought about this till you just mentioned music, though, an old school LP experience, right, was you go buy the record, you bring it home, you take it out of the sleeve, you have the liner notes and all that stuff, you throw it on the record player in the living room, and you start playing it on the stereo, and you start flipping through, and looking at the album cover and flipping it over and reading through the liner notes and all that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Apple mm-hmm. tried to recreate that experience on the desktop, but that's an office experience. That's I'm sitting out at my desk experience.
Right.
What happens now if they were to do the same sort of thing, but with digital music in the Apple TV and your Siri remote, and you're sitting in your living room, so you get that new album, you pull up the music, and then on screen along with the music and the track list, you have, additional content, images and notes and things from the artist as they were producing the album. And that's a really interesting new experience. But I mean, that gets to, and maybe that's not the thing, but I think the idea is what you're talking about in terms of developers developing new experiences on this new platform that are going to be very different. A good example that's happening even right now is the new shopping experiences that, like, I've heard great things about the QVC app and even the Gilt app, and Amazon could be, not that they're going to be on there, but if they wanted to, they could create a whole new sort of living room shopping experience that we haven't seen before, and it could be amazing.
I didn't mean to poo-poo your idea, by the way. My thought was that's what Kinect is supposed to be, in theory. I don't know who's going to go back and do the liner notes for Sammy John's Chevy van.
Right.
You know, 40 or 50 years later. But I mean, certainly, Drake? I probably has some amazing stuff going on in Kinect. I haven't actually touched Kinect since Apple Music launched, but sorry, I didn't mean to poo-poo your idea at all. I mean, it's fascinating to think about. I wonder what this device is going to be a year from now. I wonder what, my primary use case is probably still going to be to watch Netflix. But I wonder what things I'm going to be doing with Apple TV a year from now that don't even exist right this minute.
Yeah, it's going to be, and I even kind of doubted Apple a little bit when Tim Cook said, we think the future of TV is apps. But because I listen to guys like you and have been reading a lot about this stuff and through my own experiences with some of the apps that have already shown up, mm-hmm. I see exactly what you're talking about. I mean, there are going to be... apps are really going to, in a lot of ways. I don't think apps are the future of television in terms of TV content. And I guess maybe that was the problem. I was thinking they were specifically referring to, the NBC app and the HBO Go app and the Netflix app and stuff like that. I don't know that those are going to be really changed revolutionary experiences with the Apple TV. It's these other ones like home shopping or like education. I mean, there's going to be some amazing classroom kind of apps and experiences that you could throw an Apple TV into a classroom, have a big screen up there, and maybe even interacting with kids on individual iPads or, you know, Android devices, who knows, where you're controlling and running virtual experiments and maybe even video conferencing at the same time with, you know, a guest presenter at a university. Those sorts of things can all sort of happen on this one screen in this one space. And yeah, I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see what people do. It's a new way of thinking about the stuff that I don't think we have before. Our televisions have always been this one way sort of box, right?
Mm-hmm.
Flip something on, now entertain me, monkey. right? But
yeah.
Now you can kind of create an interactive experience. And depending upon the environment, you know, if it's me alone in my living room and doing a game or doing something, that's one experience. If it's, you know, a business conference room or a classroom, that's a whole nother experience. So it's kind of exciting. All right. Are we, I think we were going to maybe talk about Steve Jobs. Do we want to do that a little bit? And the fact that, I mean, only from the standpoint, the movie, I mean, not the man. The standpoint that it's like, the movie was announced, a lot of people were excited about it, myself included. It got some great Oscar buzz and all that stuff. Everybody who's seen it that I've talked to seems to really like the movie. But it was sort of panned in the technical press in a lot of ways as not being representative of Steve Jobs. And the box office dropped off very, very quickly. And the news this week was they're basically pulling it from most theaters. And it's critically, at least financially, considered to be a flop, barely doing better than maybe the Kutcher movie.
But doing considerably better than Jem.
Yeah, so like I think they're around 16 million in box office, maybe a little more by the time people are hearing this. But I mean, it costs 30 million to make. I have no doubt that it's going to be fine once it gets into video and stuff like that. I think they're going to make their money back over time. But I don't think anybody who was making the film that necessarily went into that because they wanted this huge box office success. I think, you know, both Danny Boyle and Aaron Sorkin said they even kind of took pay cuts on their normal rate because they just really felt this was a film they wanted to make. And I thought it was great. I saw it twice. I absolutely loved it. Very entertaining film. And I think it's worth seeing. And I'm just frustrated because I think a lot of the people who panned it in the technical press didn't even bother to see it and just dismissed it wholeheartedly. And I don't think that's the right way to form an opinion about something.
It's gone. I didn't get to see it. I figured I would have time. I'm embarrassed to say I did not. I meant to go the first day that it was out. It came out right around Halloween, and I was actually working on a mask for my wife to go to some event.
Cool.
And so I missed it that first weekend. The second weekend was Halloween. I had stuff to do and I figured there would still be time. And right. Then by the time, I guess last weekend is when it left, last Friday.
Well, I'm guessing it's going to be in iTunes and other digital forms probably more sooner than later now.
Very much.
They
want to
make their money back.
Very much looking forward to seeing it. And we'll probably actually just go ahead and buy it outright. I mean, based on the kinds of things that you were saying and based on, I love Aaron Sorkin's writing. I'll probably just go ahead and I feel certain I'll own it without even seeing it, without having seen it. But I've been trying to figure out what the deal was. I mean, let me ask you a question, having seen it twice.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a feel-good moment in that movie?
Yes, several.
Okay. They maybe should have shown one of those in the preview because every ad that I saw for it was him like Waz telling him, you know, why don't you love me? And the board voting him out and somebody yelling at him about the fact that he has a daughter that he's not acknowledging. I mean, every single part of that preview, there was nothing that indicated to me that there was going to be anything that felt good or anything that was going to be victorious or anything.
Yeah.
And I'm not looking for everything to be, you know, sunshine and lollipops, But tell me there's going to be some payoff here. And then there's also the fact that when did it end? In 97 when he's coming back to Apple?
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't even get like the glory days. I mean, you get the initial glory days, but then you get the, you know, all you're going to get is the part almost 20 years ago now where he's coming back in. We're not going to get the iPad. We're not going to get the iPhone. We're not going to get the seeming triumph over cancer, which it seemed like he had for a while. It sounds wonderful. I saw Tomorrowland earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
I love Tomorrowland. I had not seen it before because Disney did not do a good job of telling me why I should go see this movie. It was just sort of like they were like, hey, look, it's Tomorrowland. It's the future. It's George Clooney. You like George Clooney? Come see this movie. I didn't have a clue what it was. Hey, you like Steve Jobs. You like Aaron Sorkin. Hey, Danny Boyle. He's done some great directing. Come see this movie. I mean, but everything they showed me about it just made it look like a gigantic bummer. And I'm an Apple guy. You know?
It's interesting to hear you say that. Yeah.
I mean, you would think I would have been there first day. And I'm not saying, oh, it just sounds like a downer. I don't want to go. But I mean, there was nothing compelling about it. I mean,
it made it
look like Steve Jobs was a jerk. And, you know, mm-hmm. I've heard that and I didn't need, it would have been nice to see that there was, it would have been nice to see that maybe there was going to be something that would make you feel okay about going. It looked like it was just going to be depressing at the end of the 2 hours.
That's interesting. Yeah, I totally see that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ken. I think that people just, they just weren't engaged in the marketing. And I mean, first of all, they cared that much about Steve Jobs to begin with.
That was going to be my thing. Was there ever really that many people who were interested enough in Steve Jobs?
No, they don't care if it's inaccurate and all of that stuff that we're nitpicky about. They could care less. You know, it's a well-written, well-acted piece of film without a doubt. But I agree. In the marketing, they didn't make it compelling whatsoever. And hey, if you don't catch that audience right away with a big bang, they're gone. They're never going to show up to the theater, and they're certainly not listening to tech press to see what we think about it. There's no way. So I just think it was just bad timing and bad marketing, and that's why the movie flopped.
Yeah.
It'll do well on video. I agree with you.
I was talking to, I think it was Brian Chaffin, and he did point out they either should have done it, you know, within the year that he died, like Kutcher come out that first year or the second year, I don't remember, like very soon, because it obviously benefited from, I think, timing. And you know, I know that many people have panned this version of Steve Jobs as opportunistic, but I mean, talk about opportunistic.
Yeah.
Certainly the Kutcher movie took advantage of that, and I think the numbers now that this one is out have exemplified that, because this movie is, you know, 100 times better than the Kutcher movie, in my opinion.
What I thought was interesting was some of the tech press's reaction to it bombing, like, see, we told you so. And it's like, no, it's not because you told us so. It's because the audience is just not interested.
Not
has nothing to do with the fact that, you know, Apple wasn't happy about it or his wife wasn't happy about it. If you ask the normal person out there, they have no clue about that stuff. And sure enough, some of the tech Mac press, you know, huddled around that thought of, see, we told you it was going to bomb. And it's like, come on.
Yeah. So the other area of the timing is that, you know, maybe it needed to be done either right away or maybe it should have been a lot longer before they actually put this movie together. I don't know if I agree with that or not, but it's an interesting thing to think about. You know, is it just the point where there was a lot of interest when he first passed and then too many years have gone by and just there's not enough people who really care. And then had you done it later, you wouldn't have all of the people criticizing, you know, oh, it's not Steve Jobs, because it wouldn't have been as close to him still being around as it is currently. I don't know. It's just an interesting thing. It'll be interesting to see what happens around Oscar time, because if it does end up winning a lot of Oscars and things like that, if they, you know, they probably will roll it back into theaters, I would think, but who knows?
Yeah, that seems possible. Although I'm hoping it's actually just already on video by then, because I really do want to see it.
Yeah, well, I think it's still in some theaters. They didn't pull it out of every theater. I just don't know.
No, it's only, but it went from like 2,500 theaters to 400, and Buffalo is not one of the markets where it still is, oddly enough.
Well, there you have it. It's a good movie. If you get a chance to see it, if it shows up on iTunes, I think it's certainly worth a rental, especially if you're any kind of an Apple fan. And, you know, form your own opinion. Don't just dismiss it because somebody said it's, you know, it doesn't represent Steve Jobs they knew. You know, I just like to consume as much stuff as possible about the man. Cool. Well, I think that will wrap it up. Thanks, guys, for coming on and hanging out and talking about this stuff.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
So real quickly, if you just want to tell everybody what each of you are up to and where they can find your stuff and those sorts of things, we'll start with you, Ken. Where should people head?
I do a daily show about Apple news related to Apple news called macOS Ken, online at macosken.com. I say daily, but I'm taking the first 2 days off next week. So stop by Wednesday or go back and listen to the past 5 years of Apple news because it's all there. On the weekend, they do a show with Mike LaPlante that I mentioned earlier called iChart Radio, where we sort of take a few stories from the week and talk about them a bit more in depth. And then if you want to do something that's not Mac-related at all, I'm part of a show called Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast where we talk about, wait for it, Star Trek. So stop by there, too.
Hey, just real quick on that. So, yeah. You know, you guys have been going through, like, right, all the different series and things like that on Mission Log. And so you talk about the different episodes and stuff like that. And I think at one point you mentioned to me, well, you know, we're going to run out of shows eventually. There's going to be a new one.
Apparently not. Yeah. Yeah.
They're going to keep you guys in business.
We actually talked about that briefly. Well, briefly, did about a half hour on that earlier this week. So we do weekly, we talk about an episode of Star Trek. We were going through in broadcast order, but at the end of this season, we're going to break that. We're going to do all of Next Gen, then we're going to do all of Deep Space Nine, and then we'll do all of Voyager, and then all of Enterprise, and then all of whatever it is that CBS comes out with after that.
Yeah, it's cool.
But we talked about that for about a half hour earlier this week. So if you want a couple of Star Trek geeks' thoughts on that. Mission Log.
Check out Mission Log. Cool. And Victor, where can everybody find you?
I can be found over at terratech.tech, where I'm doing about a monthly podcast interviewing people in technology. I'm working on a couple right now, but they are not always easy to get lined up. But stay tuned. I'm going to put out a show on my own probably this week, just giving some of my thoughts about the iPad Pro, my workflow, and just catching people up on some of the music projects that I'm doing. I'm hoping to come out with a CD by next March or April. So,
oh, cool. I can't wait for that. And I assume follow you on Twitter.
Absolutely, at Victor Cahiao. I'm sure Adam will have it in the show notes.
Yep, we'll have all that stuff over at mattcast.com. Well, great, guys. Thanks very much. So there you go, Victor Cahiao and Ken Ray. Be sure to check out their podcasts on iTunes. I always appreciate having them on, and it's fun to talk with them. But with that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their great apps over at smilesoftware.com/maccast. Gazelle is a fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And Drobo, you can get $100 off a Drobo 5N, Drobo Mini, or Drobo Gen 3 by checking out drobo.com/maccast and using the code CAST100 at checkout. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281 MacIam9. You can leave voicemail there. You're also welcome to leave a voice message on Skype. My Skype username is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that we talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, hanging out online, you'll find me a couple different places. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or you can find us on Google Plus. The MacCast Google Plus community is at google.com/plusMacCast. And that's the plus symbol. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.